Move to the third case this morning, Hossack v. Floor Covering Associates. Mr. Serio.
Good morning. May it please the court. The issue in this appeal is whether there was a legally sufficient inference of gender-based discrimination to support the jury's verdict for the plaintiff. As your honors well know, Title VII, as stated by the Supreme Court in McDonnell Douglas, has held that in Title VII cases, it is clear that Title VII tolerates no racial or gender-based discrimination, subtle or otherwise. In this Title VII mixed motive case, under the 1991 amendments to the Civil Rights Act of 1964, a jury returned its verdict for the plaintiff upon five special interrogatories, finding all issues in the plaintiff's favor and rejecting all 4 to 6 reasons that the defendant employer gave for the employment decision. I say 4 to 6 because it depends on how you count. The district court submitted the case to the jury. There was no motion for summary judgment filed, by the way. Submitted the case to the jury upon virtually agreed jury instructions, and it set aside the verdict on the, we believe, the erroneous grounds that no reasonable inference of gender discrimination existed to support the verdict. Or, put another way, did the plaintiff present sufficient evidence to show that she would have retained her job if she had been a man and everything else had been the same?
What evidence do you have, sir, that the two parties were similarly situated?
Excuse me, I'm sorry.
What evidence do you have the two parties?
The evidence is, Judge, is that both the prima facie test has been met. They were similarly situated in that both the plaintiff and Cladis were subject to the same job alteration. For example, this case, as you know, doesn't involve the plaintiff had an affair with her boss. She was an exemplary worker, no dispute about that. It's not the affair per se which gave rise to the gender-based discrimination. The gender-based discrimination occurred when the employer said they were going to try to help keep her at her job.
No, I'm asking you, how were they similarly situated?
They were similarly situated.
One the office manager?
One was the office manager, and one
was... one was the manager.
Was the store manager, right.
Who generated more revenue, far more.
That's very true. However, the judge, the district judge misapplied Radu versus Kimberly Clark. The correct standard to have been applied was Adams versus Walmart. And Olson versus another case, Judge Evans's case. This is not a Radu type case, which the district judge relied on. Radu was a case involving somebody, they were going to get another job, and their performance issues were at stake. In this case, they were similarly situated because they were both subject to the same type of discipline and the same type of decision. For example, the plaintiff, this is a very blatant case of gender discrimination. The plaintiff was on an approved vacation, Trial Exhibit 7B, Appendix page 17, signed by both Lenz and Mary Gallup, the Director of Human Resources. After her husband discovered the affair, she told her boss, and he told the president of the company. They decided to have a meeting. She told her boss that her husband didn't want her working near Nick Cladis, the man with whom she had the affair. It was the company's idea to try to accommodate her, to either transfer her to Naperville or to transfer Cladis to Naperville. The gender-based discrimination occurred right there. The plaintiff was on vacation to until June 21, 2002. There's a letter, Trial Exhibit 1. The company was going to decide who was going to be transferred, either the plaintiff or Nick Cladis. Arbitrarily and discriminatorily, Lenz, who signed and approved her vacation request form, decided that we were going to accept her resignation, which she never gave. He decided that he wanted to keep Cladis. Cladis was the man. There was no legitimate reason to terminate the plaintiff. It was a complete ruse. She was fired for disruptive conduct. Now, we all cite McDonnell Douglas versus Green ad nauseam. However, I wonder how many of us really have read it. Well, I read it carefully. That is a disruptive conduct case, just like this one. The reason she gave for being terminated was given to her for being terminated was disruptive conduct. In McDonnell Douglas versus Green, the plaintiff was African American. He had been laid off pursuant to a legitimate reduction in force. A year later, the company solicited in the newspaper job openings. He applied for the job opening and was turned down. He filed suit under Title VII, claiming racial discrimination and also his involvement with the CORE, the Congress of Racial Equality. The Supreme Court said an employer can fire somebody for disruptive conduct so long as it is either racially neutrally applied. In this case, the decision to transfer or not to transfer him or her was discriminatory.
Do you realize that you're into your rebuttal?
I'm going to sit down now. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr.
Sarah.
Ms. Doyle?
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Linda Doyle. I'm here for the defendant appellee. As an initial matter, Judge Plunkett did not apply the wrong burden in this case. In fact, he analyzed the evidence under every conceivable burden of proof and found no direct evidence, no prima facie evidence, and no circumstantial evidence.
If FCA's concern was that Hossack's husband might come to the store seeking revenge, wouldn't it have made more sense to terminate him or transfer him, the person who was the subject of the threat?
Your Honor, it may have made more sense to a person not involved in the business, but that's not the issue in this case.
But doesn't that raise a factual sort of dispute that it was appropriate to leave with the jury? In other words, that motivation. The company said the reason that, you know, they wanted her to move was because of the threat that the husband made to Cladis.
Well, there were two things, Your Honor. There was the threat and the fact that he was the revenue generator, which she does not dispute. He was the top salesman in the company, and sales are attributed to the store. So moving him to another store would necessarily take away the revenue of the Joliet store.
Right, but of course that's what happened when he, about a month later, was it a month or a short time after he was moved?
Yes, and as Judge Plunkett pointed out, the reason that move was made, which Ms. Hossack did not even try to dispute, is because the employees of the Joliet store were upset with him because they blamed him for Ms. Hossack having to leave, and it made the work environment disruptive and untenable. So they moved him as an accommodation to the other employees in that store who had worked with her since 1997. That suspicious timing, as plaintiff calls it, has no bearing because, as this court well knows, suspicious timing must relate to the adverse action, and the adverse action in this case is the termination of Ms. Hossack. It may not have been the best decision in the eyes of a layperson jury, Your Honor, but it was not gender discrimination not to transfer Mr. Cladis. As Your Honor pointed out in questions to counsel, these individuals are not similarly situated in any way that's relevant in this matter. He was a general manager, a top salesperson, and a revenue generator. She was a bookkeeper with office management responsibilities. She told FCA that her husband was very upset about this affair. She told FCA that her husband didn't want her working with Mr. Cladis anymore. She told FCA that her husband cried all day and that her daughter was concerned that he would hang himself. She admits that after discussing the option of transferring Mr. Cladis, her husband called Mr. Cladis and said, "Stay away from my wife or I'll make your life miserable." She also admits that her husband called Mr. Cladis's wife and told her about the affair. They're similarly situated in no way And contrary to plaintiff's assertion, that is an absolute requirement in this circuit under Radu and under the case that plaintiffs offer to you, the Adams case. Adams says quite clearly that these two must be similarly situated in position and in conduct, and they are neither in this case. The parties argue that this is a mixed motive case, and the plaintiff must prove that gender is a motivating factor. The fact that the jury believed she was terminated versus that she resigned is of no moment. All that means is that the plaintiff must prove that gender motivated the termination. The plaintiff tried to prove it under Troop, offering circumstantial evidence of two kinds: comments and suspicious timing, and evidence of different treatment and pretext. The circumstantial evidence is not enough. First of all, the comments do not relate to gender, as they must. In order to have comments be sufficient circumstantial evidence, they must obviously, or at least by inference, refer to gender. These comments are gender neutral, and as Judge Plunkett pointed out, they actually support FCA's reason that they were concerned about the business, not the affair itself, but the trouble that the affair created, as Judge Plunkett said in his opinion. She also discusses this transfer option, which Your Honor questioned me about. As I stated, that is not sufficient evidence because it is not relevant. Timing of it, suspicious or otherwise, is not relevant because it is not the adverse action at issue in this case.
What about this whole dispute about whether she resigned or not? Because she vehemently denies that.
Absolutely she does, Your Honor. What she admits, though, is that based on her initial conversation with the general manager, David Lenz, he could have believed that she intended to resign because she said, "My husband doesn't want me working with Nick Clattis." And as I stated earlier, whether she resigned or whether she was terminated is of no moment. That's the first question of the three questions the jury must answer. The second question is whether that termination was motivated by gender. Plaintiff failed to meet that burden of proof. Plaintiff claims that it's circumstantial evidence that he was fired and she was not. That's simply not enough. They're not similarly situated in circumstances, conduct, job, or otherwise. Plaintiff also argues that pretext is enough. Quite clearly, it is not. This court has so held in Marshall versus American Hospital Association, the Supreme Court so held in St. Mary's Honor Center versus Hicks, and the Supreme Court so held in Reeves. Even if pretext were enough, pretext finding is not reasonable in this case for one critical reason. The plaintiff admits all of the facts that underlie FCA's stated reason. She admits she told FCA her husband was upset, that he didn't want her working with Clattis, that her daughter was concerned that he was suicidal, and that he called and threatened Nick Clattis. All of that supports FCA's reason that this decision was driven by concerns for the business, and if one of them had to go, it needed to be her, because he was the top revenue generator, and he did not engage in any of this conduct, nor did his spouse.
There was no evidence that this was a disciplinary action because of the affair itself.
There isn't, Your Honor. It's because of the trouble that came after the affair based on the comments and actions of her husband. It's an unfortunate situation, but there's no evidence of gender discrimination. There's no prima facie case. There's no direct evidence. There's no circumstantial evidence. Her pretext evidence, even if reasonable, which we believe it's not, is simply not enough. For all of these reasons, Judge Plunkett's order setting aside the verdict was proper.
Thank you.
Thank you.
How much time? You have 3 minutes, Mr. President.
As we all know, the plaintiff can prevail if she shows either pretext for discrimination or the defendant's reasons are unworthy of credence. That's crystal clear. We showed, not pretext, that the defendant's 4 to 6 reasons were not worthy of credence, and the jury's verdict expressly shows that. Secondly, this thing about whether she quit or whether she was fired is important. The defendant made a big issue of that at opening statement. They tried to they brought that out in every one of their witnesses. It's in the plaintiff's termination letter. They insisted on the special verdict form. Question one, did she quit or was she fired? The jury expressly found she had been fired. This court has followed Desert Palace and Reeves, most recently in about 4 or 5 cases, Mather, Massey, Tart, and a few others cited in our brief. And getting to Judge Coffey, your question about the similarly situated, if you look at pages 13, 14, 15 of our reply brief, there's a discussion of that on the similarly situated situation. Kimberly Clark, Radu versus Kimberly Clark has not been followed in cases where it's a disciplinary matter. Why was this woman fired? She was on an approved vacation at the time. Approved in writing, Exhibit 7B, page 17 of the plaintiff's appendix, signed by Dave Lenz, the fellow who decided that they were going to get rid of her and accept her resignation, which she never gave, and keep his buddy Nick Clattis. That was found unworthy of credence by the jury, that all of the reasons that her husband was going to come in with a gun and shoot the place up, he was going to hang himself, he was going to hurt Nick Clattis, he was going to hurt somebody else, all disproved. First, at this point, all of defendants' arguments in her brief and here are irrelevant. After a full trial on the merits, the burden-shifting paradigm is completely inapplicable and inoperative. The sole issue is whether, considering all the evidence together, there was sufficient evidence to create a reasonable legal inference that intentional gender discrimination was found. The jury expressly found that in questions 3 and 4 of the special verdict. Thank you.
Thanks to both counsel. The case will be taken under advisement, and the court will be in